The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra FA Cup fifth round special. Tim Krul's water bottle wins a penalty shootout for Norwich at Spurs as Eric Dier gets compared to Eric Cantona for the first time in his career. Elsewhere, let's not build him up too soon, but take the best bits of Souness, Dalglish, Baxter, Johnston and Law. What have you got? Billy Gilmore, the young Scot, single-handedly beats Liverpool, who've now lost 3 in 4. We'll do the rest of the fifth round as Newcastle reach the quarterfinals for the first time since the war. Plus, there's more Fitbar pain for Rangers, a Nations League draw no one knew about, a Premier League preview and plenty of your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Excellent news. Nick Ames.
Hello.
Are you all right?
I'm very well.
I'm pleased about that. And John Bruin.
Hello.
In the Barry chair.
Yes.
It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
All right. Craig asks, how much better has the FA Cup been in midweek rather than wasting a whole weekend on a few games? Nick, what do you think?
No, I don't think it's been better. Has it? Like, it's still... It clearly shows us what the FA Cup's place is now. You see, like, Kenny Jackett on Monday for Portsmouth, who had a game, I think, the previous Friday, resting his best two forwards against Arsenal because they've got a good promotion campaign in League One, and I think it's just shows that the fixture schedule is a bit unsustainable, really, and jammed in, and it's also too much football on a week between Champions League weeks, and it's been very hard to sustain a lot of interest in it. I think
I should say that Nick says. It says that as someone who's been to every game possible in the last few days, so
yeah, I'm, and
looks tired.
I am not saying that Reading v Sheffield United was a bridge too far in the last week, but
right, let's start at White Hart Lane there, shall we? Spurs 1, Norwich 1. Norwich going through 3 torn penalties. Should we go in reverse chronological order and begin with Eric Dier going into the crowd? There were originally reports last night that he was fronting up to someone who'd racially abused Jedson Fernandez. That was tweeted out by a load of fan sites and turned out to be nonsense. He was defending his brother who was at the game. The Football Association and Tottenham are investigating the incident. Jose Mourinho said, I think Eric did what we professionals cannot do, but probably every one of us would do. I am with the player and I understand the player. The fans were with the team until the last penalty kick that we missed. The person insulted Eric. The family was there. The younger brother was not happy with the situation. Obviously, John, Eric Dier shouldn't be doing that, should he?
No. But the phrase, law into your own hands, comes to mind. One thing I would say is that I was very impressed with the way that he climbed through over the seats.
It's hard to do.
In a way that I've never been comfortable with doing it myself, you know, afraid of, I don't know, splitting my trousers or something like that. But he completely... His technique was flawless, in fact, as he made his way up there.
Better than Pat Cash, or...?
Yeah, actually, that's a good one for the teenagers there, of course. Yeah,
somebody on Twitter wondered whether he was going up to get the ball back from Lamella's penalty.
So should we get on to the shithousery of Tim Krul, then? Are we all in favour of this? I mean, I sort of thought the point was the ref doesn't see it, and Paul Tinney is clearly staring at Tim Krul and just letting him... You wonder how far Krul could have pushed yelling and shouting, which is, I think there is a law about sportsmanship.
Yes, there is, yeah.
And maybe I'm just coming from a Spurs angle here. It's quite annoying when it's your team on the end of it, but everyone else in favour of Krul doing that?
I mean, there is a line somewhere. It's quite hard to place where that line is. I think probably once you start shouting, that's gone too far. I mean, there's a Joe Hart sticking his tongue out thing at Pirlo, which... didn't work. I guess sticking your tongue out's okay, but
yeah, you've got a scale of Grobbelaar, Dudek to I'm not sure.
I'd say Michel Vorm is the most polite, you know. Just
even Grobbelaar, Dudek, I feel slightly uncomfortable.
Yeah,
it doesn't feel quite on.
Everyone talks about the fact that Krul is a penalty expert because we go back to the Netherlands Costa Rica game in 2014, but I don't know if you recall, and I think this is the case. That Van Gaal was considering the other goalkeeper, putting on who he also thought was good at penalties.
Which was Michel Vaughan.
Oh, really?
Basically, just get Cillessen out of there.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
A line that isn't hard to play. You talk about where the line is with shithousery is the goal line, and Krul is off his line for the penalties.
We've found that is quite a hard line to play at the Women's World Cup.
Well, you know, that's a good point. But the referee's assistant is just staring at it.
That's his one job.
Yeah. I mean, literally at that moment.
Yes.
And again, maybe I'm just coming from a Spurs perspective here.
I felt Krul went slightly too far. But again, you don't want to be pedantic about that. But at the same time, you know, if one goalkeeper is restricting himself and the other isn't, then that's not entirely fair.
For the deciding penalty, the Gedson Fernandez one, he is 4 or 5 yards off his line, isn't he?
I suppose you could say, if he had waited until it was kicked, he'd have still saved walked it, yeah. over and picked it up. Abcat says, I didn't even know you were allowed to write on a water bottle. Managers send notes to players regularly. Couldn't he have carried a piece of paper or a flip chart and put it in the goal? You know, where's the line there?
Who was it who had the iPad? Ben Foster?
It was so long ago, Jonathan, that it was actually an iPod. An iPod Touch.
Was it?
Was it the 2000 and... I'm going to say 2009 League Cup final.
Oh, he saved one from Jamie O'Hara because he was talking about it when I was with him on the radio on Monday.
It was Ben Foster, was it?
It was Ben Foster, yeah.
I sort of feel like this is some sort of old people's home conversation. Well, I half remember things and turned to other people in the room. Did that happen? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, that definitely did happen. It was the day my nephew was born. That's why I remember that day.
Oh, many congratulations.
Yes. Well, the Netherlands-Costa Rica quarterfinal.
Yes.
I watched the end of that in a bar in San Paolo Airport with former Belgium striker Marc de Griezer.
don't listen to Jonathan. He makes up a lot of things these days. Now, look, we should say that apart from their first one, I mean, Norwich's penalties were great. A couple of them were superb, weren't they? And did they...
Campwell.
Yeah.
Campwell completely put his away, didn't he?
Mm.
The press.
And Ida as well.
Yeah.
Did Norwich deserve this victory? Players collapsing with cramp. A couple of them could barely walk by the end. What do you reckon, Nick?
Yeah, they didn't create... maybe what they usually create in a game. What you often get with Norwich is a sort of consistent level of performance, which consistently ends in a defeat as well. And they've maybe turned that around a bit recently, beating Leicester, and then this result. They weren't at their best. I don't think they played their most free-flowing stuff, but they hung in there. They got, you know, a bit of a scrambled goal, and I think it's quite easy to do that against Spurs currently. If you stay in a game, you may well come out with the other side of it. So fair play to them, I have to say.
If you were told one of these teams were bottom of the league, who would you have said on watching that football match? Tricky one.
It would be a tough call. I mean, the thing about Norwich being bottom of the league, I was chatting to a good friend of mine last night who's a Norwich fan, and he's obviously seen his team yo-yo to the Premier League and back. Obviously, they had a long absence. And he said this is probably the most enjoyable season they've had in the Premier League, in the fact that the team has gone for it and there's been some, you know, a win at Leicester this time. That's been much more enjoyable than just you straight battling against relegation and going down.
They are, and I say this as an Ipswich fan, they are, I think, the best team I've seen that has been adrift at the bottom of the Premier League, which is a pretty specific set of parameters. But I think they are. I think they are genuinely better than their results have been. And I still wouldn't bet against them staying up.
And actually, we've said this about Spurs before. I mean, the Wolves game on Sunday, if you watch those two teams, the Norwich players seem to know what they're there to do and know where they're meant to go. And, you know, they've got some very good individuals. I mean, Buendia's a tremendous footballer, isn't they? I mean, Mourinho said afterwards, talking to the BBC, he'll tell the board they have to choose to focus on either Saturday away at Burnley or Tuesday away at Leipzig, but they can't do both.
Yeah, I mean, how can you expect professional footballers to play 2 games in 4 days? Ludicrous. The demands they put on players these days.
Is their injury crisis that bad?
No, it's ridiculous. I mean, obviously, losing Kane and Son is not helpful. You've still got Moura, Bergwijn, Ali. You've still got more resources than Norwich, for instance. Just get on with it. People will be sympathetic to you because people understand you've got 2 injuries. Stop moaning about it. I mean, Son's injury, this mysterious injury that happens in the first minute of the game, apparently, and then we only find out about it afterwards. Are we sure that he hasn't Michael Caine on Kevin O'Callaghan this? Mourinho's realised that losing Caine isn't a big enough excuse. Oh, make it a clean break, skipper.
Do you think Son is such a happy footballer he'd still be smiling as Jose broke his arm in the dressing room?
You would have a lot of sympathy for Jose, I think, given what he's walked into, losing Christian Eriksen, having all of the injuries, having to put a bit of a patchwork team around at both ends. But then you can have that sympathy without him then Joseing it and ramping it up after every single game and coming out with excuses. Well, not excuses, but, you know, ploys like this.
Mia, Leicester have been without Ndidi and Mendy and then Chowdhury because of a suspension. So they've lost their entire defensive midfield. Brendan Rodgers has barely mentioned it. The Havardi's been carrying an injury since the beginning of January and has ended up missing the Norwich game. So key players for Leicester haven't been there, which is part of the reason for Leicester's sort of decline in form.
And you also see how Wolves on Sunday grew stronger and stronger to the extent that they had so much more in the tank than Spurs. It was their 46th game. And Nuno is going on in his interviews in several papers that weekend about wanting a smaller squad.
Watford went, that six games without a win. They had no Ismail Assar, they had no right back. They had no Kike Firmino and they had no Jan Mat. And so they lost their entire right side. They come back and suddenly they beat Liverpool.
Is this not a case of Mourinho, who used to be such a brave manager, somewhere along the line, and I would probably carbon date it to Real Madrid, lost his bottle somewhere. He used to do a lot of moaning like this when he was at Chelsea for the second time. Manchester United, that season when they actually won two trophies and they won the Europa League, you may recall that they actually chucked in the league position that season to get into the Europa League final and obviously to win it. It just seems that he himself can't deal with the intensity of managing two games in a week.
How long do you reckon he'll be there?
He won't. If he's there this time next year, I'd be very, very surprised. I would not be surprised to see him gone this summer unless him and Daniel Levy both decide to macho it out and prove that they've made the right decision that we can do this.
I mean, you're right that something changed at Real Madrid, but he has always use injuries to try and... I mean, if you remember, do you remember that game when they lost... Did they lose over the... It's another old people's home conversation. Do you remember that game, the League Cup semi-final away at Wickham, when he... I think he played Paulo Ferreira and Michael Essien at centre-back, and he was desperate to sign Tal Ben-Haim, who he eventually got the following summer. It must have been his last season. And he absolutely laid into the board afterwards. And I remember he was a freezing cold...
Can we just say that... I want to change to when Jose Mourinho lost it to the point when he wanted to sign Ben-Haim.
Let's just move on. Good question from Ewan, who said, who got better value? Bloomberg's POTUS campaign spend or Spurs £60 million for 5-minute fortnightly cameos from Tanguy and Ndombele? It's frustrating because he looks like such a brilliant footballer, but something is not right.
Seen the clips of him trying to track back, not tracking back at all on that Wolves counter attack towards the end on Sunday, and you're just thinking, what's going on there? Because like Mourinho's probably tried to cajole him quite a bit, and maybe he's gone in on him a little bit in press conferences in a way that some players might not appreciate, but it's a basic requirement.
But the Mourinho cajolery doesn't work anymore. In a way that you've seen players at Manchester United that wouldn't run a leg for him suddenly putting all their effort in for Ole. In a similar way, actually see Everton as well with Marco Silva's players who wouldn't run a leg for him now putting it all in for Ancelotti.
I think this is what changed at Real Madrid. Something at Real Madrid made him lose his faith in players, because when he was complaining at Chelsea the first time round, it was us against the world and us being him and the squad, and the board was part of the opposition. Whereas since Real Madrid, it feels like it's him and the squad is part of the rest of the world. It's all against him.
Yes,
maybe,
that's right.
Maybe his support of Eric Dier will be the turning point for Spurs' Champions League win. Victor Wanyama has signed for Montreal Impact, the team managed by Thierry Henry. His time at Spurs sort of declined, didn't it? Two great moments, one that absolute banger at Anfield, and two, the picture of him holding some spaghetti. Norwich will play the winner of tonight's game between Derby and Manchester United. Interesting Wayne Rooney interview with Ben Fisher in the paper today, talking about how centre mid is a much less intense role, lots of jogging, less sprinting. And on match days, he wants to become a manager. Rooney arrives earlier than the rest of the players to finalise tactics with Philippe Cocu and his staff.
I've heard him speak on the Championship coverage, and I've interviewed him a couple of times, and he's talked like a manager or a coach, talking about working with certain players, improving certain players in a way that if you'd have told me 10 years ago that that would have been Wayne Rooney, I'd have been quite shocked. Mm. Actually quite impressive.
Yeah, Chelsea 2, Liverpool 0. A tweet from Jacob Steinberg. Lampard has outwitted Mourinho twice, given Klopp 3 good games, beating him once. He's got through a hard Champions League group, is in the last 8 of the FA Cup, 4th in the league. He lost Hazard and had a transfer ban. It's far from perfect, but not bad for a manager in his second season.
I mean, some of that is true. Yeah, I think they were pretty fortunate to get through the Champions League group if you think of what happened. I mean, they were very good away against Ajax and pretty bad at home and got away with a draw at home, you know, with the two red cards.
Do you feel you need to redraw your thoughts on Lampard yet at all?
They have played really well 3 times against Liverpool, that's true. They've also lost 3 times to tactical mastermind Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. They've also failed to beat Eddie Howe's Bournemouth twice this season. So there's a massive inconsistency of performance there. And the two things that I keep coming back to is they can't defend set pieces and they keep getting done on the counter. And both of those mean you don't quite get the results you probably should get. And against a team like Liverpool, I guess, because you're not really taking the game to them, you know, you sit deep, that danger of getting done on the counter isn't there to the same extent. If you think back to the game at Stamford Bridge, how did Liverpool get their 2 goals? Set pieces. So the 2 big flaws, which he may be able to put right, but the 2 big flaws remain there. And my problem with Lampard is less some sort of absolute assessment of his managerial capacity. It's that he gets a very, very easy ride, that nobody mentions these flaws. And they're going to finish lower in the league this season than they did last. Last season, they got to the League Cup final and they won the Europa League. Well, they might win the FA Cup this season. I suppose he might still win the Champions League, but it's very unlikely.
True, but you know, Hazard is a great footballer. But they now have Billy Gilmore, who can do everything. He's a superhero. How much of anything did you know about him before Tuesday night?
Well, I did know this, that Barcelona, he was at Rangers, I think, wasn't he? He was a younger, Barcelona looked at him years ago, or not years ago, because he's not even that old enough for there to be years involved, but and thought he was a player of genuine talent. An agent friend of mine told me that a while back. But he is another one for the teenagers. He is the classic Scottish ball player.
So he done Pat Cash Escape to Victory and yeah. Classic Scottish ball players.
Yeah. Well, he's just, you know, small in stature. And actually, okay, another one for the teenagers, that John Giles phrase, moral courage.
He was brave
and, you know, against players who are, you know, you are playing essentially against the best team in the world, yeah. Or it's a slightly different iteration, fearless as well.
I thought that there's something I love about football is that reputation kind of counts for nothing. This fearless kid outshining a collection of really quite good midfielders, Nick.
It was a fantastic performance, and I think it helps that Liverpool seem to have kind of gone over a bit of an elastic limit, I think, in the last few weeks, which I think does happen when you've been performing at such a high level, such an incredible intensity, such a consistent level of performance too. And then you have, I don't like the phrase winter break, because it wasn't much of a break, was it? But you have that little punctuation point in the season, and then you have to get up and go again. And I don't actually think it's a very easy thing to do. And they've been flat since then. They were pretty diabolical at Watford the other night. There have been warning signs in the post in the three previous games, really. And I think the other night was a pretty good occasion for young Gilmore to strut his stuff, and strut it he did.
Also a huge fan of just the name Billy Gilmore, because there's no way he's not a 1920s footballer with that name, to which I tweeted that, and a man called Rich replied going, amazing to have such a football career, along with 15 kills flying a Sopwith Camel during World War I. Dobry says, Burnley have a youth player called Teddy Perkins. Rumours that he operates a moonshine distillery in his spare time are unproven. Ross Barkley scored an absolutely beautiful goal in this game.
He suddenly clicked into form, hasn't he? I'd sort of written him off almost. And well, like suddenly, you know, England's Euro 2020 squad seems to be falling apart, and suddenly Ross Barkley's emerging as being the most informed of all of them.
Well, I find it really hard to know how good he is. We're talking about Grealish, you know, and Grealish v Maddison and who should get in the England squad, and you write that list of midfielders and you sort of put Barkley on the list because he's picked by Southgate, but he's sort of dismissed by everyone because he's not new or he's not brilliant, or maybe he is. I'm not sure how to rate him.
I was at the game with Bayern Munich last week when Chelsea obviously got absolutely eviscerated eventually. But in the first half, Barkley was on my side and also Frank Lampard's side, quite near the press box, and it was quite notable to me that Frank was for most of that half in his ear the whole time, almost talking him through it to an extent that he wasn't to the other players. And okay, against Bayern, you have got to have a particular structure off the ball and stick to it. But I wonder whether he's just somebody who has lacked that bit of game sense and needs to be coached a bit more than other players. Because Frank was on him for 45 minutes, and I think in the second half, Russell was probably quite happy to be a bit further away from that dugout.
I mean, it is Lampard's position, I guess. So, in terms of tactical advice he can impart, that's what he's going to know best.
Well, the thing is, though, he's a player in his mid-20s now. He's been a prodigy. He was a prodigy when he was at Everton all those years ago. But he worked with managers like David Moyes and Roy Hodgson for England, who were always... who did not want to release Ross Barkley's talent. Before the 2014 World Cup, there was one of the friendly games that they played over in North America. He showed his sort of real dribbling talent, and there was talk of him being a Gazza ahead of that tournament. It's not quite happened for him. I think, actually, last season, working for Sarri, and Sarri's making the player be much more disciplined and play the ball slower and think about the tactical position, has probably helped him and helped him develop. And obviously, Frank Lampard wants him to generate another part of his game.
He's more rudimentary than a Gascoigne, isn't he? But he's got more discipline.
Yeah. But the goal he scored, actually, it was one of those, it was like, Is he going to pass it? Oh, he scored.
Yeah. And also, I mean, absolutely brilliant that it hit the angle where it hits the camera in the goal. Someone tweeted me perfectly saying it would be great for the boying bit of the grandstand theme.
Well, yeah, they used to have it in St. Greaves as well, which I think it was Ian Rush hitting the 86 FA Cup final.
Well, why would you only reference later than that?
Exactly.
When I first saw it, I wondered if Adrian was slightly at fault, but he's not at all, is he? No. I mean, Adrian's dive is a sort of, it's an old-fashioned dive. It's sort of, the angle of it looks wrong, but it's just because the shot's
the
so hard.
Made by Hamish McAlpine, so going back to the 1980s.
I mean, it's sort of a Weetabix dive, take it back even earlier.
If you want to pick a mistake from Adrian, you probably pick the first goal,
yes.
I imagine. Kepa was in goal for Chelsea. Richard Jolly's first tweet of the pod. Kepa's made more saves in the first 31 minutes against Liverpool than in any game this season. Five.
Was he not helped by having to make all these saves in...
in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Having a great scramble. So three defeats in four for Liverpool. What's going on?
Well, I think the point that Nick made, they've gone over the hill a bit. The break that they had, which Jurgen Klopp wanted them to all go on holiday. Jurgen Klopp's used to the winter break, of course, though he has been here nearly 5 years. He probably ought to be used to the schedule by now, but he's used to the winter break being the chance to go off to a training camp in Mallorca, refresh the players so that they're fit and raring to go. It looks to me as though they might have misjudged how to manage this, but you know, they had set such a high bar that the percentage drop off. I imagine Jonathan is going to say this. Jordan Henderson is also a big miss for them as well, missing that leadership.
So Liverpool play Bournemouth on Saturday. Chelsea play Everton on Sunday. In the quarterfinal, Chelsea will go to Leicester in the next round. Spoiler alert, if you don't know that Leicester are through. We'll cover that and the other games in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Burberry Perry writes, got tickets for the Glasgow live show. What's the dress code? How would you describe the dress code for a live show?
As formal as you can.
It is, yes.
And most people, we don't insist on black tie, but if you can, that's preferred.
Yeah, tucker the lot.
Yeah, a white tie is if you want to be in the front row.
Yeah, the front row, obviously, yeah. Yeah.
9th of March, Glasgow. Well, next Monday, isn't it? Next Tuesday, Edinburgh. Are there still 14 tickets remaining for Glasgow? Come on. Will you be part of the Glasgow 14? 23rd of March, the lineup has been announced for Earth in Hackney. Max... that's me. I'm talking about myself in the third person. Barry Glendenning, Lars Sivertsen and Flo Lloyd-Hughes will join us. So come along, please. On the 9th of April, we're back in Leeds. It is me, Barry Glendenning, Jonathan Wilson and one other. So let's see if your name, Wilson, swells the ticket sales in the Headingley area. Is that where we are? It's not far. No. Well, we're nearish to if you're in Headingley, that's the show you'd go to.
Yeah. I mean, you can get there in half an hour from Headingley quite easily.
Yeah, there you go. Or the Harrogate area, even. You know,
yeah, all those. Yeah, Weatherby.
Yeah, Weatherby. Yeah, it's true.
Marcelo Bielsa, he could pop along.
Mm. Someone did tweet, will we get through a pod without Wilson mentioning Marcelo Bielsa? There we go. There's your proof. Right then, to Fratton Park. Portsmouth 0, Arsenal 2. This was a pretty regulation win for Arsenal. I thought they were roughed up a bit. And they stood up to the test, Nick.
Yeah, there was a bit of excitement, I think, when I look back on the commentary team in the first half about Portsmouth giving it a real go and Arsenal being massively subpar. But I think in the cold light of day, it was cup tie by numbers, wasn't it? It was the lower league team having a bit of a flurry and a bustle in the first half and then ultimately quality telling. But I don't think it was a small achievement for Arsenal to gather themselves and come out quite as convincing winners, because if you look at the youth of the team that played, you've got Nelson, you've got Saka, who gets talked a lot about and quite rightly at the moment. You've got Eddie Nketiah up top, who I think is has got this quite delightful old school poacherishness about him. There's a lot more to his game. I think Arteta is particularly impressed with his intelligence and how he will press exactly how Arteta wants, which a lot of those players aren't.
Which is interesting, given Bielsa clearly didn't think he had that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was one of the main reasons he didn't get in for Bielsa was supposedly his work outside of the box. But Arteta is, from what I gather, pretty convinced about it. So he showcased that. They all did. Good to see Reece Nelson, who is another player who Arteta absolutely adores. There's a lot of talk about whether he can do a bit of a Raheem Sterling with him. Come back, probably be Arsenal's best player. And I think, it wasn't a tie that will live long in the memory. But I think, down the line, I think Arsenal are going to have a few problems this summer. They probably won't make the Champions League. They're going to have to probably sell players. I'm pretty sure one or two might not want to stay. So these young guys are going to be the future. There's going to be some tough calls to be made further down. And I think it is a good sign that they can come down to somewhere like Fratton Park, which, okay, we mentioned earlier, Portsmouth rested one or two. It was a noisy environment. It's as we all know, a tight environment there. And I thought they came through fairly convincingly.
Torreira was injured early on. It's just been confirmed he suffered a fractured ankle. No return date currently for him. Was that a terrible foul by James Bolton or just an unlucky result of a firm challenge? It feels like in the Premier League with VAR that I think that would have been a sending off.
It'd be called excessive force, I think, wouldn't it? Because he got the ball, I think, but he thundered in, as I think you've alluded. This is another of those things where I don't really know where the line is drawn. What is excessive force? How do you judge it? Do you judge it on the consequence, which is the player going down in a heap and, as we now know, being quite seriously injured? I mean,
there's always a danger doing that, but I don't know. Excessive force is one of those things you sort of know it when you see it, and I guess maybe it is slightly conditioned by consequence. But there are some challenges where you sort of think, if you go in with that level of force, then you cannot be in control. And once you're out of control, then it becomes reckless, and that's when it is a red card. So
it's a bit like, I'm at risk of getting pelters for this, but if you look back in 2008 at Martin Taylor's challenge on Eduardo, which was one of, like, if you talk to the physios who were involved in treating it, they'll say that was the worst injury they've ever seen, bar none. It was absolutely horrendous. Taylor straight red, but actually, when you look back, it was mistimed and not a good challenge. But you will see every week two or three much worse challenges than that that don't have a consequence.
Guendouzi was booked, wasn't he, for gesticulating. Gunner blog writing, Mike Dean booking someone for over-the-top gesticulating is the height of irony.
I think he was quite surprised that Arsenal had been given a free kick, and there was a bit of chat around it. And then he emphatically, sarcastically placed the ball down.
Yeah.
So he basically got booked for not even gesticulating, for being sarcastic, which I think would give most of us quite a disciplinary issue in our everyday jobs, I'd have thought.
No, of course it's right. You can't show visible dissent.
Is it dissent?
Are you on the side of Mike Dean with this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that
yeah.
dissent?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with Jonathan on this.
So, Arsenal go to Sheffield United in the quarterfinals. This weekend, they've got West Ham at home to the Hawthorns. West Brom 2, Newcastle 3. This was a fun game, wasn't it? Newcastle 3 up, and then I think a lot of people saying if the game had been 5 minutes longer, West Brom might have equalised. But I think the most important thing from this is just how much a cup run means to the Newcastle fans. And we've mentioned it before, but they're into the quarterfinals for the first time since 2006, which is... I started thinking, God, a lot's happened in my life since 2006.
I mean, that is brilliant. And it's good that they've got the home tie in the quarterfinal. And I'm going to be in the Northeast that weekend. I very much hope I get to go to it. But before, I mean, I've seen some people kind of saying, well, the show Steve Bruce is doing a brilliant job. They've beaten Rochdale and Oxford. You saw them, they've beaten this season. So it's not that hard.
With replays.
And with replays. And West Brom. So... you know, brilliant they're there and they should enjoy it. And I hope that it's a good game against City. And if they go through, good luck to them. But let's not get carried away with the achievement of getting there.
Should we praise Miguel Almirón a bit? Because he spent ages until his first goal. Now he's started scoring a few and he's a nice footballer, isn't he?
I enjoy watching him play, yeah.
Almirón not just scored, but two really good finishes. Yeah. And Saint-Maximin looking really good, which is interesting given the apparent spat or non-spat.
Well, Steve Bruce says it isn't a spat, let's get set that straight.
And he's very angry at people who say it's a spat.
Who's in the spat? Saint-Maximin and Bruce?
Yeah, so it was reported that Saint-Maximin thought he was fit to play Burnley and Bruce didn't think he was. And quite how animated that discussion was depends who you want to believe, but... He clearly was fit enough Tuesday night.
Steve Bruce and the journalist involved, the Daily Mail's Craig Hope, who's a very good reporter, have something of a running battle, I think it's fair to say.
Right. While we're on West Brom, Jonathan Lecco's released a statement following the publication of the FA's written reasons for the 8-game ban given to Leeds goalkeeper Kiko Casilla for the incident which occurred when he was on loan at Charlton. He said, "I would urge the game's governing bodies to look into their own processes when such incidents are reported. It was 22 weeks between the incident and the hearing, during which I had minimal contact from the PFA, of which I'm a member, and no contact in the way of support from leading anti-racism bodies such as Kick It Out and Show Racism the Red Card. Some support or guidance would have been very welcome. By bringing the incident to the referee's attention immediately, I was only doing what I've been educated to do throughout my career. I found the hearing at which I was made to feel I had done something wrong extremely stressful. It made me question whether I would be prepared to go through it all again, were I on the receiving end of similar abuse in the future. I certainly would think twice about how to advise another player placed in the same situation." There have been a few responses to this, one from the PFA, which said, "We'd like to apologise to Jonathan. We do not want any player to feel unsupported when going through something as difficult as this. At the time of the incident, we reached out to the club to advise them that we have a dedicated equalities team in place that can support and guide Jonathan through the investigation and hearing process. This is usual procedure following a racist incident. Unfortunately, on this occasion, we did not hear back and wrongly assumed that Jonathan did not require our support. We're grateful for Jonathan's feedback and will review our procedures to ensure we learn from this moving forward. Following the hearing, we reached out to Jonathan directly and have subsequently arranged a meeting, which is due to take place tomorrow." Sanjay Bhandari, chair of Kick It Out, said on Twitter in response to a Times journalist, "We will provide considered comment on Casilla judgment on Thursday. To clarify, Kick It Out reached out via the proper channels to Charlton twice in the week following the incident to offer support to Jonathan Lecco. Neither offer was taken up. More importantly, I feel for Jonathan Lecco that he did not get the support he needed for what would have inevitably been a very stressful experience." There are a few things to pick out here. One is a point that Jonathan Lecco makes. 22 weeks seems an incredibly long time for this to take place.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand how it can take that long. Obviously, you have to talk to witnesses. You've got to consider what they're saying. You've got to compare what they're saying. But they're not hard to track down. I mean, they're all on the pitch. You know who they play for. So I don't get why that should take so long. I also don't understand why the written reasons for the decision come out after the verdict. Because what that allowed was sort of a weekend where Leeds fans could feel put out and feel that they'd somehow been... hard done to here. And I don't think releasing the decision on a Friday afternoon especially when you wait 22 weeks, I don't think that's particularly fair. But when you read the written reasons, it is pretty damning. So I think the process of producing those written reasons feels thorough, but whether it needs to take 22 weeks, I don't quite get. That doesn't seem satisfactory for either party.
I suppose the thing would be that the document is a legal document and these things take a long time to put together. My memory of the Luis Suarez affair, and which viewers could probably never forget, really, is that the judgment was passed down, and obviously Liverpool fans were up in arms, and the actual findings, the document was released on New Year's Eve, 2011, which I spent that evening reading, actually, which shows how exciting my life is. And that appears to be the way that it operates, that they hand it down a few days later. It's not particularly satisfactory in both cases. I don't know why they had to do that. And as you said, Jonathan, there were a lot of Leeds fans saying, oh, we've been done over here. Perhaps when they actually read the case, that they were able to say, okay, maybe it's a correct decision.
You mentioned the reasons for the judgment. It was found that Casilla had called Lecco an effing N-word. His defence was that he had never heard of the N-word before the accusation was made. This seems highly implausible.
I think in the end, it doesn't even matter. He said it in a context where it is toxic and awful and horrible to say it. So I think that should be the end of the matter, no?
And there are witnesses to back it up as well. I think the thing that you started with, Max, is Lecco's complaints about the lack of support from the PFA and Kick It Out. But the blockage in this appears to be, just from those statements, that Charlton, and that appears to be what they're alluding to, didn't get involved in the process.
Charlton's executive chairman, Matt Southall, on Twitter writes, "Reading Jonathan Lecco's statement has left me deeply saddened. To think a black player would consider not reporting racist abuse aimed at them is shocking. Football has a duty of care to protect players who've been abused in this way. But if the process is too demeaning, lengthy or damaging, what does that say about how far we've truly come? To hear Jonathan so angry and distraught in his statement makes me wonder whether football as a sport is merely paying lip service to the fight against racism. Manager Lee Bowyer said at his press conference this morning the club had supported him since day one. To have something like that hanging over you, especially as a young player, has to be difficult to carry. You could see he wasn't himself. He's a bubbly and confident lad, and he was a bit quiet for a while after. But the group got him through that, and he was himself again. While he was here, everyone was around to support him." So specifically, the statement from Matt Southall, the Charlton executive chairman, has not addressed whether they passed on the offer of support from the PFA and Kick It Out.
It seems to be a lot of finger pointing going on, and in the midst of this is Jonathan Lecco feeling isolated.
That's the key, isn't it? At the end of the day, you have a 20-year-old who is questioning whether he did the right thing to report racist abuse,
which he did.
And football is a small world, right? So everybody in football will know someone who knows someone.
Yeah.
So the point is that there are people in all those organisations who know lots of people who can. There's a procedural way to go, obviously, to say this is officially how we support you. But also there is a way in football that if somebody wasn't all right, or you wanted to check if someone's all right, you could do that.
The procedures are there for a reason. You do have to follow procedure. I think anything with unions and whatever, the procedures legally are quite important. But yeah, you would have hoped that some message could have been passed back to kind of, do you want to push this procedural issue a bit harder? Mm.
Right, Sheffield Wednesday 0, Manchester City 1, Aguero's 23rd goal of the season. Anyone slightly surprised by how strong a team City put out, given how busy they are?
No, because they can rest players in the league whenever they want, and it's not going to matter. I think City have got the... it's really... You know, when you think how sort of tepid they've been at times this season, to see the kind of the real bloody-minded, we're just going to win every game from now at the end of the season, that'll teach you. It's quite good to see. I'm quite amused by it. I'm quite enjoying it. The City determination to kind of, we're not going to be knocked off course by the ban.
And it's also the determination to win every trophy apart from the Premier League. So you know they're going to win everything.
Well, Liverpool wobbling. You never know.
Well, all right.
Nick, are you? Is your heavy typing? It's as strong as the at the end of the A Team. Do you remember the typewriter that went into a C at the end of the A Team?
A Larson.
Is it pod related, or are you doing some admin?
It was very much pod related.
Okay, great.
But you're right. I type like this with my fingers jabbing down. I get taking my mic out of quite a lot. I type like someone's granddad or something. I was just looking for.
Yeah, well, you in the old people's home. It's fair enough.
You know, we're among friends here. Yes, the attendance at Hillsborough last night, I was trying to get the exact attendance, 20,995. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it holds about 38?
Yes, I think that's about
right.
Is that
right? So that's almost a half full crowd for a crunch big FA Cup game for a team that is going absolutely nowhere in mid table against, you know, almost the best team in the land, probably the second or third best team. Now, I think this. I don't know enough about the malaise that is enveloping Sheffield Wednesday at the moment, but it must be pretty heavy to have a half full attendance. And it also makes me wonder about the merit of sticking the FA Cup in a midweek as well, because surely, if this was the centrepiece of your season, you'd want the place to be full and pulsating.
39,732
well, there
is
we
the
go, half,
capacity.
I'm half full, and I'd be genuinely curious to know the reasons for that.
Robert says, Chris Waddle was doing the punditry on the BBC. Which of the panel would Chris Waddle's haircut suit best? I think we could describe it as, is it Thomas Shelby's brother, the slightly unhinged? I mean, they're all unhinged in the Shelby family, but the most unhinged of all the Shelbys.
I don't know, this is the 1980s.
Who's
over
the Shelbys?
Here.
They're in Peaky Blinders.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, right. I don't watch that.
Oh, you don't watch that? Okay. Yeah. I'm upset that they...
It reminded me of Gary Oldman in The Fifth Element? It is Fifth Element.
Yeah, so, shaved at the sides, long on the top.
It was a sort of early 90s, Ned's Atomic Dustbin, Pop Will Eat Itself type of hairstyle. Pretty brave for a man in his mid to late 50s.
Mm. I mean, if we're generous, I'd say of the current panel... Best to give it to Nick.
I was about to stick my hand up. Like, I'll take anything that's even yours. I'll take. So.
Right, Reading 1, Sheffield United 2. After extra time, Nick, you were there. How devastated were you that this game went to extra time?
Oh God! Seriously, it was I mean, I'll get my tiny violin out, but it was about my sort of sixth or seventh game in the previous week, so I watched it through slightly glazed eyes. I'm told I didn't miss much. It was Sheffield United won in extra time, which is always a bit gutting because you think they might as well take us to penalties now they've dragged us this far. Not a great game. Billy Sharp, we can talk about Billy Sharp.
All right, let's talk about Billy Sharp.
Yeah, there's always time to do that. He scored the winner in the 105th plus 1 minute. Nice little typical close-range header. And that was the chat afterwards. I think he's now 34. That was his third goal of the season. It's his third spell at Sheffield United. And he, if you remember, he came back 5 years ago, I think, and scored 20-odd goals in a... In that season when they finished 11th in the third tier and were doing nothing, and then Chris Wilder came in and whoomf, off they go. And I think he's quite a nice symbol for everything they've done in that time and for the team they've got now, that you've still got so many players in that team. And you could list five or six of them who've come through from League One and are now gunning for a Champions League place. And they weren't at their best by any stretch the other night. He changed probably the midfield, was their second choice midfield, but otherwise it was quite a strong team. But I think it's testament again to the job that Chris Wilder has done, that he has got so much out of these players, that players who were performing in League One 4 or 5 years ago are now on the verge of Europe, and they are, and it says everything for them, which I think I wrote in my sort of slightly crazed match report. You know, it says everything that the Cup is the second most likely European option for them now. So, fair play.
Billy Sharp, three times as prolific as David McGoldrick, who got his first goal of the season. Didn't really look that bothered about it, but well done to him. Leicester beat Birmingham 1-0. Ricardo Pereira, 8 minutes from time with Leicester's first goal in four matches. Quiz time, everybody. Pereira's fourth of the season in all competitions. He's the second highest scoring defender in all competitions. He plays in the Premier League. Behind which player?
Jan Vertonghen.
Nope.
Van Dijk?
Nope. Scored at the weekend. Right wing back. Producer Jonathan's got it.
Can we Google?
No.
Oh.
Who plays wing backs?
Come on, Wilson.
This is the old people's home classic, isn't it? You're right, it's Matt Doherty.
Of course.
Importantly for Leicester, Wilfred Ndidi was back after a month out. And Jude Bellingham, the Birmingham player, built reporting Dortmund of an agreement in place to sign him for what would be a club record £30 million and would be a club record fee on both sides of the transaction. He's just 16. So have a nice time if you go there, Jude. You look like you're about to say something.
No, I was suppressing a burp.
Well, very good of you. The FA Cup draw then, Sheffield United, Arsenal, Newcastle, Man City, Norwich v Derby or Manchester United and Leicester City v Chelsea. In Fitbar, Celtic extended their lead at the top despite only getting a point at Livingston. They needed an injury time equaliser from Tommy Rogic. It's because Rangers' miserable run continues. They lost 1-0 at home to bottom side Hamilton. David Moyo scoring after some real League Two defending. It's a 13-point gap. The Ackies leapfrog Hearts, who had leapfrogged them on Tuesday night after a 3-1 win in the Edinburgh Derby at Easter Road. The second goal, an absolute beauty from Oliver Bozanic, just side-footing it in from 25 yards. It was really nice. Hibs' Mark McNulty appeared to stamp on Hearts' Sean Clare. I mean, appeared to. Did. The Hibs striker received no punishment from the ref. So Hearts were off the bottom for a day. Also, we missed this last week, but we talked about it earlier in the season. James Keatings, the Inverness Caledonian Thistle player, who was banned for the Challenge Cup final after receiving a second yellow card for a dive in the semi, which wasn't a dive, and failed his appeal because one of the judges didn't watch the footage, has finally had his ban revoked. So something good in football. He said, "I know what it's like to play in cup finals. It's one I didn't want to miss. It means everything. For our part in discussing that and bringing it to the attention of the Scottish football authorities, James, you can thank us when you score the winner with a celebration of Barry's choice when he's next back on." That'll do for part two. Part three, the Nations League draw has happened. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the Nations League draw. League A, Group A2, England, Belgium, Denmark and Iceland. League B, the other home nations, B1, Austria, Norway, Northern Ireland and Romania. B2, Czech Republic, Scotland, Slovakia and Israel. B4, Wales, Finland, Republic of Ireland and Bulgaria. Does anybody care yet?
Well, if they've been the Euros off, we might have to. This might be the Euros.
That is a very interesting question about whether the Euros will happen. Clearly, none of us are experts in this at all. So we, like you listening, are just waiting to see what happens. But
yeah, last night I saw a tweet from American journalist saying it was 100 days till Euros kicks off in Rome, which, yeah. So 99 days now.
Yeah, well, it was announced yesterday by the Italian government that all sporting events in Italy will be played behind closed doors until the 3rd of April.
Well, and all schools and universities closed in certain regions. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a pretty major step to have taken.
Yeah, it's extraordinary times. This week's Coppa Italia games were already called off, so haven't taken place. The Champions League last 16 second leg between Juve and Lyon will be played behind closed doors, as will Valencia v Atalanta, even though it's been played in Spain. Getafe against Inter and Barca v Napoli could also be affected. Obviously, sport is secondary to public health and safety, but this is something to think about with regards to the Premier League. There have been discussions already about the possibility of playing games behind closed doors. And this morning it's come out that the government has asked the league to step up those preparations. There's the friendly between England and Italy at the end of the month to think about too, which is surely in doubt. And more long term, the Euro start in 3 months. And we don't know when the virus will peak, of course. Harry Kane, if it happens, has said, "Unless something pretty drastic happens between now and then, I'll be there. I'm still not back training with the first team, but I'm working hard in the gym. I'm getting stronger all the time." He was speaking to the Evening Standard. "We're talking a few more weeks and I'll be playing again. I don't want to make a prediction for which game I might be back. I'm hoping somewhere between the start and the middle of April." Premier League this weekend then. So Liverpool-Bournemouth is the early kickoff. Can anybody see Bournemouth adding to Liverpool's current mini pain?
No.
It's at Anfield, isn't it?
Yes.
No.
John?
No.
But if it happens,
then the choke headlines begin.
Arsenal West Ham. Mike says, "Max, any chance the pod can mention the 8,000 people who turned out to protest against Gold, Sullivan and Brady on Saturday before the West Ham-Southampton game. I think there hasn't been many protests that big against an ownership.
I mean, it's a long-running thing. It's boiled over, hasn't it, since the move to the stadium on actually both sides of the argument. Tempers running pretty high. It's a sad story, really, because, you know, the London Stadium is not what... Actually, it's not what a lot of them wanted in the first place, and it's not what was promised. So it's an unsatisfactory situation for so many West Ham fans. The club would argue that there is a silent majority who accept life the way it is, but certainly that minority has been particularly vocal. And the ownership are prepared to be unpopular, it would seem.
Palace, Watford, Sheffield United, Norwich, Southampton, Newcastle, Wolves, Brighton are the 3 o'clock games on the Saturday. Burnley, Spurs is the 5:30 kickoff. And on Sunday, you have Chelsea, Everton, Manchester United, Manchester City, the Manchester Derby at 4:30 with Leicester Villa on Monday night. In Germany, fourth tier Saarbrücken have reached the semi-finals of the DFB Pokal with a sudden death penalty shootout win over Fortuna Düsseldorf. Keeper Daniel Batt saved 5 penalties, 1 in the second half, 4 in the shootout. They'll play Bayern Munich in the semis. To qualify for this season's Pokal, they had to win their regional cup last season. This cup run dates back to September 2018. Düsseldorf were the second Bundesliga side they've knocked out on this run. He made some great saves in the shootout, doesn't he? And Sal says, on a scale of Italian 90 to old Wembley goal and net combos, how would you rate this? I give it a solid 7 on the account the keeper saved everything and I haven't seen the net ripple. To me, they look quite Sunday League, those goal nets, or quite League Division 4 from the 80s.
Oh, I don't know. I think my concern there, I mean, it's a classic D-hoop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the loss of a D-hoop from modern football is a great shame. What I don't get is there's also an external stanchion, which, you know, appears to have a string kind of sustaining the net out. Now, that seems like belt and braces to me. I don't understand why you need both. But I'm a big fan of diversity of goal nets. I think the homogeneity of a goal net is one of the worst things about modern football.
The greatest goal net?
Oh, I mean, you see, it depends what you want.
You obviously need a variety, but if you have to pick anything, you're going Mexico 86.
Mexico 86, but see, I think you're of a generation as well, that Mexico 86 was special because A, they were yellow, and B, they were those boxy nets that we weren't used to in the UK.
They were so long.
But I look back now, and if I were making my own stadium and had carte blanche to have my own whatever goal net I wanted, mm-hmm. I'd go D-hoop. I think D-hoop with a fine grade net. You want the net to be closer to the bridal veil than the tattered fishnet, if you will.
I remember turning up at Portman Road in like the summer of 96 and seeing they'd got the box net and thinking Ipswich are there now.
Yeah.
We've got the top flight net. Nothing can stop us. And now I sort of play for the half-assed blue job that we used to have before that.
So. Well, colours are important. I think if you look back to sort of, when was it? I think it was sort of 15 years or so ago. I think in Seville in 2003 for the UEFA Cup final between Porto and Celtic, the net was black. And there's something very continental about a black net.
I mean, but when Bournemouth went red and black and you couldn't really see the net, I found that a problem. I didn't like it when Cambridge went sort of yellow for a bit. I would like Wembley to bring back the old Wembley.
With the neutral green classic A-frame. Slightly deeper than your classic A-frame.
And I think one team in the Premier League should have to have square goalposts just for the randomness of it.
Well, Hampden, of course, famously had square goalposts at the Nice Saint-Etienne in 1976.
Well, yes, I was about to mention that. Daniel Sturridge's ban has been increased to 4 months. He left Trabzonspor by mutual consent earlier this week. He's had his ban for breaching betting rules increased after an appeal from the FA. He was initially banned for 6 weeks, with 4 of them suspended. After the Independent Commission ruled, he'd instructed his brother to place a bet on the transfer to Sevilla, which then failed to happen. He said on a YouTube video, "I just want to say it's been a very long, drawn-out process over the last couple of years. Difficult to concentrate on my football. I'm going to continue to campaign for professional footballers to be able to speak to their families and close friends freely without the real risk of being charged. I feel the betting companies and the practice and process of people placing bets on players moving clubs has to be stopped." It's a strange
I've read this judgment. Mm-hmm. I've spent the week reading judgments, actually.
Shouldn't save it for your next New Year's Eve.
Yeah. That's what I hope to do this New Year.
Which is better, that New Year or coming around mine to watch serial killer documentaries?
It was yours, Jonathan. It was definitely yours. I actually agree with Daniel Sturridge that betting on next manager and player to move to clubs, it's
so exploitable,
open
isn't it?
To abuse. Mm-hmm. But having read the judgment, and which involves WhatsApp conversations between Daniel Sturridge and Daniel Sturridge relatives, I'm not sure that I can countenance the view that he has that it was just private conversations between them. The story is, it doesn't speak well of Sturridge and the Sturridge family, really.
I was 7-4 to get the pod when Jimbo left, and I'd already been offered it. I already had taken it, but I was too scared to put a bet on because I didn't want to go to prison or tell anyone.
But wait, when does it become insider trading? I don't know either. Regulations are on that.
I don't know. It seemed the wrong thing to do to bet on something that I already knew would happen.
500-1 to be Jack Ross's replacement Sunderland manager. I could have laid that quite heavily, confident that I wouldn't get the job.
I don't know if I'm still 100-1 to get the Cambridge job. I don't know if I've
still not appointed anybody.
No, because Mark Bonnell's doing well as a caretaker. George Mendes' home has been searched. The Portuguese attorney's office confirmed it conducted dozens of searches on Wednesday in connection with its investigation into tax evasion and money laundering at some of the country's biggest clubs, as well as the home of George Mendes. We'll update you when we get anything. This is from Max, following on from Barney Ronay's revelation about Tottenham right-back Sir Jaurier, as he hears it. Maybe we could have a thread on misheard footballers' names. I've only ever heard I'm Eric Laporte, as if he's Spartacus to all football commentators. Also an email from Paul, who said, hearing Barney's flight of fancy about Sir Jaurier reminded me of a lecturer during my time at university in Leeds in the early 90s who was fond of the Marxist philosopher Herbert Marcuse. Marcuse said this, Marcuse said that. It took me a few weeks to realise he was not referring to the powerful Manchester United striker of the time. Damien says, can't believe that with all the pirate-based gags about Shaletto, you didn't think he'd be the biggest champion of VAR. I went a bit farmer there. Question from Adam, is the best pie sweet or savoury? I'll go to you on this, John.
Savoury.
Chicken and mushroom?
Cheese and onion that they used to do at Macclesfield Town.
Fair enough.
Holland's pie, beautiful.
Horser says, you ask what we do while listening to the podcast. I often find myself enjoying the pod while doing the late night, usually 11 p.m. to midnight, bottle feed for our 8-month-old twins. They've been listening to the pod twice a week for most weeks of their entire lives. God knows what this is doing to their tiny minds, but there are no apparent ill effects so far. If their first words are a treatise on VAR, I'll let you know. I can, however, agree with a listener you mentioned a year ago who said that Barry's dulcet tones appear to have a very soporific effect. And finally, Peter says, I'll be in the tail end of a London marathon training run while listening to this. Any chance of a shout out, please? We'll probably hear you around 20 kilometres in, and that'll be a lovely boost towards the end of the run. Cheers, Peter. Would you like to say...
Come on!
Thank you very much, Wilson, and that'll do for today. Thank you, John.
Thanks.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Barry's choice when he's next back on. That'll do for part two. Part three, the Nations League draw has happened.
Shit, who's got
it? Has it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Who have England got?
Belgium, Denmark and Iceland.
How is it three teams? Is that right? There was not two teams last time.
Yeah, it was only Spain
moved the groups. Remember, Ireland didn't get relegated despite losing every game because they shifted the groups around.
Oh, they ruined it. I like the old format.
Maybe they can merge it.
The halcyon days.
Like the 82 World Cup second.
Are we rolling?